It is a really strange thing to think about, but you can actually spend almost your entire life living everywhere except where you actually are.
Oh, absolutely. It's pretty common.
Right. Like, just think about your own experience this morning. Your mind is this relentless traveler. It basically packs its bags the absolute moment you wake up.
Yeah, the second your eyes open.
Exactly. You
Yeah.
open your eyes, and suddenly, you are building these elaborate, terrifying futures that will probably never even come to pass.
Or you find yourself reconstructing past conversations, right? Like searching for that perfect comeback to win an argument that ended, I don't know, 3 years
Oh,
ago.
guilty. Totally guilty of that. Your mind plans, it regrets, it judges, it just constantly escapes. It is always in motion.
Right.
But, and here's the thing, while your thoughts are wandering across decades and continents, your physical form, your body remains completely stationary.
Just sitting there.
Yeah, you are sitting in the car or you're sitting at your desk. Your body is literally the only place that is always exactly here. It knows only the present moment.
It is an incredibly humbling realization, I think. We abandon our physical selves constantly.
Yeah.
The mind takes off on a flight, and we just leave the body sitting there, completely unattended in the present moment, just waiting for us to return.
And that dynamic, that exact dynamic, is the central mission of our deep dive today. We are exploring a truly beautiful, grounded article by Ilya Tamir about the actual lived reality of mindfulness.
This is a fantastic piece.
It really is. Our goal here is to narrate the story and the ideas within this piece, moving way past the clinical jargon that usually surrounds this topic.
Yeah.
We want to understand what it truly means to, as Tamir puts it, come back home to the body.
Right.
So, okay, let's unpack this. Because this act of returning to the physical form, it isn't some modern clinical invention, right?
Exactly.
It's not a trendy wellness hack.
No, not at all. I mean, to understand the mechanics of how this works, we really have to look at its foundation. The root of this practice traces back roughly 2,500 years.
Wow, okay.
Yeah, to the Satipatthana Sutta, which is a foundational discourse in Buddhism. And what is so striking about this ancient framework is that it wasn't built on like an esoteric mystical
But
concept.
it's not magic.
Exactly. It was built on a very simple physical reality, which is just attention to the breath.
Because the breath is, well, it's the ultimate anchor to the current second.
Right, because you physically cannot breathe in the past.
Yeah.
You can't take a breath in 1999, and you cannot breathe in the future either.
Like you can't stockpile inhales for next Tuesday.
Exactly. The body breathes only right now. So whenever you realize your mind has traveled, say, decades into the future to panic about your retirement savings,
Which happens to all of us.
all of us, but the sheer physical sensation of inhaling brings you instantly back to the only moment that actually exists.
Which is such a grounding thought. But I feel like for a long time, that kind of practice felt, I don't know, walled off.
Yeah, like inaccessible.
Right. It felt like you had to be a monk in a mountaintop monastery to access it. But then you have teachers like Thich Nhat Hanh who took this mindful breathing and just extended it far beyond the meditation cushion.
He really did. He brought this ancient practice into the most ordinary, mundane moments of daily life. I mean, he applied it to dishwashing.
Dishwashing.
Yeah, and drinking tea, he understood that you do not need a sacred space to find presence. You don't need a temple. You don't need absolute
You
silence.
just need to be there.
Right. You only need to inhabit the physical reality of whatever moment you are currently in. As he famously framed it, mindfulness allows you to live deeply every moment that is given to you.
Even if that moment is just, feeling the warm, soapy water on your hands while you're standing at the kitchen sink. So we have this profoundly spiritual practice rooted in ancient texts, living for centuries primarily within monasteries and spiritual communities. How on earth did a practice like that become a cornerstone of modern Western medicine?
Well, that's a fascinating pivot.
I know Jon Kabat-Zinn is the major figure here, establishing the stress reduction clinic at the University of Massachusetts Medical School back in 1979.
Right.
But wasn't his background actually in hard science rather than just like spiritual teaching?
It was. He was a professor of medicine emeritus, and he actually held a PhD in molecular biology from MIT.
Wait, really? MIT?
Yeah. And that rigorous scientific background was the exact architecture needed to translate that profound spiritual depth into a structure that the rigid empirical medical world could actually utilize.
That makes so much sense.
And the interesting part is he didn't start by applying this to people who just wanted to, relax or reduce their daily work stress.
Who did he apply it to?
He applied Buddhist practice directly to patients suffering from severe chronic pain. These were individuals who had fallen entirely through the cracks of conventional medicine.
Oh, wow. So people who were basically out of options and just living in constant agony.
Right. For these patients, their bodies felt like unbearable prisons.
I can't even imagine.
If you are in constant severe physical agony, you spend all your mental energy trying to escape your physical reality. You want to be anywhere but in your physical form.
Right. Your mind is just desperate to flee.
So Kabat-Zinn did something completely radical. He taught them how to safely inhabit those bodies again.
And he built what we now know as mindfulness-based stress reduction.
Right.
Right, or MBSR.
Exactly. Which is now offered in over 700 hospitals worldwide today.
That's incredible. And the founding hypothesis of his clinic was, I mean, it was elegantly simple. It was just that the practice of mindfulness could help alleviate the pain and suffering associated with chronic disease.
Right. Not by curing the underlying disease itself.
Right. But by changing how the patient actually relates to the pain itself.
And that brings us to how this actually functions in a modern therapy room today.
Yeah, let's get into that.
When Tamir sits in the clinic with a person in pain, the goal is to help them find that exact same anchor in the body that Kabat-Zinn was using. Fusing mindfulness into therapy requires a very distinct shift in perspective from how we usually view the therapeutic process.
Actually, let me push back on this a little.
Sure, go ahead.
Because traditional therapy is usually about restructuring a thought, right? Mm. If I am sitting on a therapist's sofa and I am absolutely terrified that I am going to be completely bankrupt in 3 months, just breathing isn't going to pay my mortgage.
This is a very fair point.
Shouldn't my therapist help me look at the evidence,
yeah,
you know, dismantle the logic of my fear, and basically prove to me why that disaster won't happen?
Well, examining the logic of a fear and dismantling it is incredibly effective for many people. Cognitive behavioral therapy does that brilliantly, but mindfulness is doing something entirely different here.
Yes.
It changes your relationship to a painful feeling, rather than trying to change the content of the feeling itself.
Okay, there's an analogy from the text that perfectly captures this difference. Tamir writes, "The intellect tries to solve an emotional flood by building a dam of logic, but it rarely holds."
It rarely holds.
I love that visual. A dam of logic against an emotional flood.
It's so accurate. Let's look at a warm, grounded scene from Tamir's daily practice that illustrates this perfectly.
Yeah, set the scene for us.
So a client sits on the clinic sofa and begins to spin this complex, terrifying narrative about their life. You can physically see the flood happening right in front of you.
The panic setting in.
Exactly. Their words speed up. Their breathing becomes really shallow. Their mind has completely left the room and is currently living in that projected disaster 3 months from now.
And if the therapist tries to argue with their narrative, like if they try to build that dam of logic you mentioned, they are just joining the client in the labyrinth of their panic.
Right. Because when you are in the middle of a panic attack, logic does not register.
You just cannot spreadsheet your way out of a physiological response.
You really can't. So what is the turning point in that room? What does the therapist do instead of arguing the logic of the bankruptcy?
They ask the client to pause, right?
Yes. They ask them to stop talking about the story of the future altogether and simply locate the feeling in their physical form right now. They'll ask, where does the anxiety live in your body in this room?
And usually that's a very physical sensation, like it is a tightness in the chest, a hard knot in the stomach, or, you know, this sudden heat rising up the back of the neck.
Exactly. The therapist then guides them to focus entirely on that physical sensation. They ask the client to just breathe into it without trying to push it away.
Which has to be terrifying.
It is the hardest part of the work because the natural human instinct is to reject pain. We want to push it away. But the therapist asks them to just let the body hold the sensation.
And then what happens?
When they do, something incredible happens. Slowly, the physical intensity of that emotion peaks, and then it begins to subside.
The mind realizes the body's actually safe in the room.
Exactly. The person comes back home to the present moment. What's fascinating here is how this connects to other clinical lineages.
Yeah, we see this exact mechanism woven into other major clinical frameworks too, don't we? Frameworks that most of our listeners are probably familiar with, like internal family systems or dialectical behavior therapy.
Yes, IFS and DBT.
They aren't strictly Buddhist, but they use this exact same anchor.
Right. In IFS, you are working with the mind as an ecosystem of parts. So maybe you have an exhaustingly hardworking manager part or a deeply anxious part carrying burdens from the past.
Okay.
IFS relies heavily on this exact type of self-observation we see in mindfulness. It teaches you to identify the anxious part without becoming consumed by it. You anchor yourself in that core observing presence, the self.
So from that anchored place, you can look at the terrified, anxious part with compassion rather than being hijacked by its panic.
Precisely. You watch the part react, but you stay rooted in the body. You don't become the panic.
And we see that same mechanism through a different lens in DBT, right?
Oh, absolutely. Mm. DBT was built specifically for individuals experiencing profound emotional dysregulation.
Right.
You cannot simply tell someone who is in absolute emotional agony to just change their thoughts. They have to radically accept the reality of the agony first.
Radical acceptance.
Yes. DBT teaches non-judgmental observation as a core distress tolerance skill. When emotional pain spikes, you observe the emotion exactly as it is. You do not label it as good or bad, and you do not rush to fix it.
Because if you try to fix it before accepting it, you're basically just panicking about the panic.
Right, you're layering it.
Both of these frameworks seem to rely on the fundamental mindfulness principle of stepping out of the mental noise and resting in direct non-reactive awareness.
Yes, you gain distance.
You watch the mind travel, but you decide to keep your feet planted firmly on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
You simply notice the departure and gently guide your attention back to the physical sensation of sitting in the chair.
And, you know, the concept sounds incredibly peaceful when we discuss it analytically like this.
That sounds lovely.
But the reality of trying this for the first time is pretty gritty.
Here's where it gets really interesting, because we have to paint the picture of what this actually feels like for you, the listener, if you try to sit down and do this today.
Yes, let's talk about that.
You decide to stop managing your life for just 5 minutes. You sit down, you close your eyes, and almost instantly your mind feels caged. A profound resistance rises to the surface.
It's immediate.
Suddenly your legs get restless, your skin starts to itch for absolutely no reason. Your breathing, which literally happens automatically all day long, suddenly feels manual and awkward.
Yeah, and there is an overwhelming, nearly magnetic urge to open your eyes, to get up, to check your phone, to solve a problem, just to do anything other than sit still in that physical space.
And the immediate reaction for most people is, you know, I am failing at this. My mind is too loud. My anxiety is spiking. This meditation stuff clearly does not work for me. I'm just not built for it.
Right. And that is exactly where the therapist has to step in and reframe this entirely.
Oh, so?
That intense rebellion is not a failure. The resistance itself is part of the practice.
Wait, really? The urge to run away is part of the practice?
Yes. The urge to escape your physical form is the very mechanism of your suffering being exposed in real time.
The mechanism of suffering exposed in real time. That is a powerful way to frame it.
When you sit there and feel that agonizing itch to run away, to check the phone, to escape the moment, and you choose to stay in the chair anyway, that is when you are doing the actual work.
You are basically watching the mind pack its bags, and you are refusing to buy the ticket.
That's exactly it. The practice is not about achieving a state of glassy, untouched calm.
Right.
It is noticing the desperate desire to be somewhere else and choosing to remain in the body anyway. It is the slow, deliberate conditioning of the nervous system. It teaches the brain that staying present will not destroy you.
And it is fascinating because researchers in Israel, like Maddie Lieblich and Asaf Federman, have spent decades basically proving this exact point.
They have.
Federman calls this the healing paradox of controlled behavior. When you try to exert direct self-control over an emotion, when you forcefully suppress a feeling of panic or sadness, it backfires.
It completely backfires.
The struggle to suppress it only amplifies the suffering.
Because non-judgmental acceptance actually increases real self-regulation. You gain agency through acceptance, not through willpower.
That is such an important distinction.
You stop trying to manipulate the experience. You let the body hold it, knowing the body is strong enough to weather the physical sensation of the emotion.
Right.
And as researchers like Lieblich have shown, by building rigorous academic programs around this, you can absolutely integrate that profound spiritual depth with the highest clinical standards.
Okay, so if the goal is to just sit there and endure this physical resistance, what is actually happening to the brain while we do that?
Well, that's the big question.
I have to ask this, because wellness blogs and magazine covers have conditioned us to believe that sitting on a cushion, literally builds a new brain in 8 weeks.
Right, the magical brain rewiring.
Exactly.
Yeah.
We've all seen those colorful fMRI scans showing like glowing spots that promise total neuroplastic transformation. Is that not the ultimate proof of why we should sit through the agony?
This is where Tamir argues we have to practice absolute intellectual honesty.
Okay.
It is incredibly easy to get swept up in the romantic idea that meditation acts like a magic wand for your neuroanatomy.
Right.
The wellness industry desperately wants simple, highly shareable narratives about brain rewiring because people want a physical, structural cure for a non-physical pain.
Seeing a glowing spot on a brain scan makes the healing feel tangible, makes it feel real.
Exactly. And for years, there was a study that everyone pointed to.
Which one?
An early, smaller study conducted by Holzel at Harvard in 2011. It provided exactly that kind of narrative. It suggested that MBSR actually increases hippocampal gray matter.
Wow. Okay. That sounds huge.
It was a beautiful story. The idea that sitting quietly could literally build new brain tissue in a matter of weeks was incredibly appealing to the public.
But clinical truth requires a willingness to look at the full picture, right?
Yeah.
Even when it complicates the story we really want to tell.
Exactly. And a much larger, far more rigorous study was published in 2022 by Kral in the journal Science Advances.
Okay. And what did they find?
Well, this study involved 218 participants, and it did not confirm this increase in gray matter.
Wait, really? It just didn't show it?
It didn't. Tamir states this plainly because true therapy rests on facts, not comforting illusions. If you build a therapeutic practice on a promise that a brain scan will magically change in 8 weeks, you are setting people up for failure.
Because depth without structure collapses.
Yes.
So what does this all mean? If the physical architecture of the brain doesn't drastically change, if the fMRI machine doesn't show a glowing new hippocampus, why should you or I sit to the agonizing itch and the restless legs? Why bother fighting the urge to check the phone?
Because the behavioral efficacy of the practice rests on incredibly strong ground.
Okay.
Even if the gray matter doesn't dramatically expand in an 8-week window, the behavioral outcomes are undeniable in clinical settings.
Like what?
For example, mindfulness-based cognitive therapy, which is studied heavily at the Oxford Mindfulness Center, is a proven, highly effective method to prevent depression relapse.
Wow. Okay.
And the structured application of MBSR across those hundreds of hospitals consistently shows profound results for chronic pain and stress.
So the subjective experience of the patient improves drastically. Their ability to live their life returns, even if the structural scan of the brain looks exactly the same.
Exactly. What matters in the clinic is not whether an fMRI machine detects more gray matter.
Right.
What actually matters is whether a person can finally breathe through a panic attack without losing their anchor to physical reality. That is the true measure of success. Can you stay in the room when your mind desperately wants to flee?
Which really brings us to the ultimate takeaway of this deep dive. When you strip away all the clinical labels and the acronyms, what is this practice actually treating?
Right.
According to Tamir, it treats the secondary suffering that comes from abandoning the present moment.
Think about how these conditions operate on a mechanical level.
Okay.
Anxiety pulls your mind into a terrifying future that hasn't happened. Depression drags your mind into a heavy, regretful past that you cannot change. And chronic pain makes your mind desperate to escape the physical reality of the present.
In every single one of these conditions, the mind basically packs its bags and leaves the physical location of the self.
Yes. The therapeutic work is just the slow, repetitive process of coming back.
And I think it is so important to offer some warm encouragement here to anyone listening. Your mind will always try to travel.
Oh,
it will build new futures to fear. It will dig up old pasts to regret. That is not a failure on your part. That is simply what human minds do.
Right. It's just biology.
Healing isn't about achieving a state of eternal, unbroken bliss where you never have a distracting thought again.
Healing begins the exact moment you stop following your thoughts into the labyrinth. You do not need to become a completely different person.
Yeah.
You don't need a newly rewired brain. You only need to notice that you wandered off and choose to return because the body is waiting exactly where you left it.
It is the only place that is always here. Which leaves us with a final thought for you to mull over today. Since your body is the only place that is ever truly here, how often are you leaving it completely unattended while you live out imaginary scenarios? The next time you find yourself arguing with a ghost from your past or bracing for a future disaster that hasn't even happened yet, what physical sensation can you use as a homing beacon to pull yourself back into the room?